From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. This is our daily look at the arts and culture of Atlanta and the creative minds behind it. Today, we're hitting the theater, the concert hall, and the bookstore. Local author Laurel Snyder has been nominated for no less than a National Book Award for her novel Orphan Island. We'll hear her talk about her approach to that story this hour. Will Ransom celebrates 25 years of the Emory Chamber Music Society. And first ahead, there is a tiger on the loose at Seven Stages. Seven Stages takes its audience into the heart of Baghdad in its upcoming production. Set in 2003, Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo follows Marines, their translators, and indeed a tiger as they navigate the war-torn streets of Baghdad. Seven Stages artistic director Michael Haverty is with us in studio, along with actors Joe Sykes and Mariam Khalid. Welcome.
Hi, Lois.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, it's so good to have you here. First, tell us about the perspectives in the play. The tiger is actually one of the primary voices of the story.
That's correct. The tiger is played by actor Kevin Stillwell. It's noted in the script that he is not to be played in any way feline, but he is definitely the biggest character on stage. He is the largest force of nature that wanders the streets of Baghdad searching for the meaning of life.
And listeners may remember reading, or perhaps even had the privilege of seeing, Robin Williams in his last Broadway role as the tiger.
That's right. It was a lauded performance by Mr. Williams, and really sad that we didn't get to see any more work on stage.
I know. But he did nothing stripes, nothing costumed related, just a scraggly beard and, you know, the force.
But it's a really brilliant choice by the playwright Rajiv Joseph to place this wry character full of dark humor into this very dark situation, because it leavens the play. And so we're not just caught up in all the tragedies that happened along with the Iraq War. We're following someone who has a sense of humor as he witnesses the absurdities of war all around him.
Joe, you play a Marine who loses his hand to the tiger, and then he has a very peculiar mission. Would you tell us a bit about Joe and what he has faced in the Iraq War?
Well, Tom, my character Tom, he loses his hand. It gets bitten off. And what is it like to act with one hand? That was sort of fun to explore. Every 2 hours in rehearsal, we have a 10-minute break, and that's when you go and do your business. You might go to the restroom, check your phone, talk to your friends. When I would go to the restroom, I would keep my prosthetic hand on. And it took a few times, but I figured out how to do everything I needed to do.
Is this going to be too much information?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
It's not too graphic, but I figure out everything I need to do with one hand, which is sort of enlightening as how I'm going to play the rest of the character. I'm a person who's missing a part of himself, and I'm trying to preserve the rest of myself. And so it's a big deal to try to do everything single-handedly.
Literally and figuratively. Mariam, what research did you do for your character to understand what it was like being an Iraqi during the war?
Well, Michael had sent us a lot of articles and books to read, and I sort of dove into the articles, and the more I read, the more I started to get a very broad idea of the war and what was going on. And then I stopped. Because for my character, Hadia, she's from a small town. She's a young girl who's brought into the city and immediately after is killed. So I wanted to narrow my view of what this war was. The war was inside my home. The war was within my family. The war was what we experience here, in a sense, when we're listening to the radio and hearing about the news so far away. So at a certain point, I started shifting away from literal research, you know, news and articles, to more of a character study and accent research and going back to the roots of the language and things like that.
Yes, I understand. You engaged a vocal coach or more than one for dialect?
We did. We found a lovely woman, Tala, who lives in Colombia, and we had Skype interviews with her with all the different characters. There's extensive Arabic spoken in the play, and we mm-hmm. heard from many of the local Middle Eastern population in Atlanta how different that Iraqi dialect was. So we wanted to make sure that we got that right.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely. Because I used to live in Dubai as a kid, so I used to speak Emirati Arabic. And I was a little cocky going in. I was like, I got this. And then I started reading the Arabic, actually paying attention to all the enunciation and the way the khs and the ghs are. And holy moly, I had to start from scratch.
Very different. Yeah. I know someone who studied Spanish in Barcelona mm-hmm. and then later spent time in Madrid. And eventually got a job in Mexico thinking, hey, I'm fluent. Mm. And the Mexicans laughed very yeah. hard yeah. when they heard her
All
speech.
Three of those locations are very different.
So different. And, you know, I have to commend you for this, Michael, because I know Seven Stages did not want to take this on until you could be authentic in terms of achieving the proper dialect and having actors of Middle Eastern background.
That was really important. We knew, especially right now, that there was no way we were going to whitewash any of these characters. Rajiv Joseph wrote this play with these Iraqi characters, and it's so important that their voices and their faces be heard and seen on stage. That was one of the main reasons for choosing this play, is that it shows the Iraq War from this totally different perspective. And so we wanted that perspective to be as unique as Rajiv wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. And I think what Miriam said about history is really, really correct, that we did a lot of research. We had Marines come in and teach us how to hold our weapons properly, how to conduct home searches. We did the dialect work. But the playwright didn't just write a purely historical play. It's leavened with this magical realism. And it's the fact that it's all derived from history that makes it really hard to forget.
We'll be back in just a moment. I'm speaking with Seven Stages artistic director Michael Haverty and actors Joe Sykes and Mariam Khalid about their production of Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, which opens this week. We'll hear more in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from Atlanta Chamber Players, presenting their opening concert on September 17th at St. Dunstan's Episcopal Church. Concert features a celebration of Beethoven with an all-star cast of ASO musicians. AtlantaChamberPlayers.com.
We're back with City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes, here with Michael Haverty, Joe Sykes, and Mariam Khalid. We're talking about Seven Stages production of Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. A moment ago, Michael, you were talking about how important it was to be true to history. This history is only 14 years old, but with all of the bloodshed and violence since, it seems far longer ago than that.
So true. And looking back on these events, as someone who really came of age during September 11th, It's been very interesting to revisit these events and then trace history as it comes to the day today through the Arab Spring, through all the conflict that we see today. And there are American footprints in the region from long, long ago. And that's one of the points that this play makes, is that when we go to different places, when we are in places outside of our home, we need to watch and listen and try to understand the way that different cultures operate, or we're going to make horrible mistakes.
Yes, horrible mistakes have been made. You mentioned as a child, coming of age during the 9/11 attacks. Of course, the invasion of Iraq was absurd in that that had nothing to do with Iraq. And that was part of what confounded the mess that
I think the trauma of that comes across in this story as well. You see the interpreter, Musa, he has a couple of names, but Musa, sort of struggle with having to work for the people, the only people who are giving him this job as an interpreter, but also, you know, stepping back and not knowing who he is in the world anymore. Because if you are a country that has started something, then you expect it back, but you can feel the underlying trauma of, I don't know why I'm here, I don't know why this is happening. And one of my favorite lines of the play is he keeps repeating how tired he is. I'm so tired. And that, I think, it's a very interesting line for the region in general. Mm-hmm. It's tired. It's exhausted of struggling.
Yes.
And the amount of ghosts that haunt him as well. There are all these ghosts.
Let's talk about that. There are characters, there are living characters and ghosts. What does that allow for in terms of conversation?
Well, it's really spectacular on stage. We get to have a lot of fun with the magical realism in terms of how we stage the ghost moments. Many characters begin as live and then end up dying throughout the course of the play, but they come back. One of my favorite lines in the play is from Uday Hussein, Saddam's son, who is a character in the play, and whose gold gun sets off so many conflicts in all the different characters. But he says, Americans always thinking that when something dies, it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing goes away in this play. Everything stays, and the questions that the characters are asking of themselves, whether they're searching for redemption or whether they're looting for gold, they continue in death and take on an even greater resonance and reverberance in the world. It's a fantastic theatrical device that helps to explode this history, again, into something a little more magical and existential.
And talk a bit more, if you would, about the voice of the tiger, because you mentioned there is levity in the play, that helps us digest the tragedy that's surrounding it or the absurdity. It's not easy with parables.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you direct the tiger, Michael?
Well, the playwright gave us a lot of tools to work with. The opening scene, we have the tiger pacing back and forth inside his cage in the Baghdad Zoo, and he's so angry and he's jealous of the lions because their cage got blown up and they all got to run out into the streets of Baghdad and have some fun. There are teenage rhesus monkeys that he's really angry. He's angry at all the other animals. But he's also really searching for meaning in his life and meaning in his death. He tells us that tigers are all atheists, every one of them unabashed, and that when he realizes he's not gone, he thought everything would just end when he died. He thought his life was, in effect, meaningless. Suddenly he starts searching for meaning and talking to the other ghosts and trying to figure out what is going on, and it really upsets him from this place of atheism. He starts trying to communicate with God, and we follow the tiger over this journey of self-discovery. But it's done in this just really wry, dark, sarcastic tone of voice that I find really hilarious, and the actor Kevin Stillwell really just makes it sail and just carries us through.
We talked about whitewashing. It's very common in Hollywood, and we've seen cases in theater as well, but I think Hollywood really takes the prize for that. I'm thinking back on sort of Anthony Quinn as your all-purpose Mediterranean,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And where Charlton Heston is a Mexican.
Oh my
touch
God.
Of evil.
I know.
I thought growing up Anthony Quinn was Middle Eastern. That's
the first movie. He is your all-purpose, shall we say, in terms of Hollywood lingo, ethnic.
Yeah.
And this is really interesting. We had a lot of Middle Eastern performers come in for auditions and perform monologues in Latino accents because that was the major work that they got in commercials and television. So diving into the auditions was fascinating, just talking to different people about the situation.
We had an Israeli filmmaker in several months back. And he said he gave up acting because he was only being cast as a terrorist. Mm. He was very olive complected. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm tired of being a terrorist.
Absolutely.
I'd rather be on the other side of the camera. But
that's so lovely in this play, too, is the variety of Arab characters, from homeowners who are having their house searched by the Marines, to a young girl walking the streets of Baghdad, to this major character, Musa, who's working with the Americans as an interpreter, which is a fascinating experience.
We've heard some horror stories from colleagues at NPR about what translators have risked working with them, and I think it's an important service provided by way of the playwright to see how key these people are in what happens literally with those boots on the ground.
And so, now we're keeping them out of the country.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically, these Iraqi interpreters, the numbers that are coming in, people we promised we would keep them safe, we're not keeping them safe. And that's more of a tragedy than anything, I think.
I didn't know Seven Stages was determined to cast actors of Middle Eastern descent before launching the production, as we said. How do you think local theaters, and I know that, Miriam, you are certainly active in your own theater company. How do you think local theaters can play a role in this larger national conversation?
I think seeing people and their potential, we were discussing this as a cast a few days ago, that it's not difficult to have a script and see who's right for the part. But what's difficult is when you are stuck in a way of thinking for so long that you don't even consider casting outside of the one color, that's going to take time to shift. And the way we start to shift that is with shows like this and with Michael taking on this beautiful journey with us, because you have to show them this is how you do it right. And yes, there aren't too many Middle Eastern or Persian or Southeast Asian actors in the city, but you keep trying, you keep seeking them out, because they're seeking you out.
Mm-hmm.
That was very soulful.
Well, yeah. No, it avoids Anthony Quinn being Greek, Italian,
right.
Tevye, you know, whatever.
Because you are sending a message when you do that. When
yes,
you cast
yeah.
a white person as a person of color, you're sending a message that's okay, and that this white person can do it just as easy as anybody else. And that's a dangerous message. It's going to silo off people from experiencing real, honest stories from diverse
right.
voices.
And to give you perspective, I can count on one hand the amount of times I've seen somebody who looks like me on stage, whether it's in Atlanta or in New York or in LA. Like, it's not a thing that we see very often. So I'm excited to start this new chapter, this new cultural shift, if you will.
Well, congratulations to Seven Stages for taking this important step. And Joe Sykes, Miriam Khalid, Michael Haverty, thank you so much for joining us.
It's our pleasure. Thank
you,
Lois.
I've been speaking with the Seven Stages artistic director, Michael Haverty, who is also directing Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. Actors Miriam Khalid and Joe Sykes are part of the production, which opens with previews this Thursday, that's tomorrow, and the show runs through October 8th.
Support for WABE comes from WellStar Kennestone Hospital, which received Gold Seal Distinction for heart valve, coronary artery bypass surgery, and congestive heart failure. Kennestone is one of only two programs in the country to receive this distinction. WellStar.org. And from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. On September 21st and 23rd, Paris comes to Atlanta as megastar Jean-Yves Thibaudet brings his stunning piano pyrotechnics to the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra's opening weekend. Also on the program, Gershwin's Beloved and American in Paris, in which the orchestra deftly dodges taxicabs, their horns blaring, and even enjoys a visit to a jazz club. Tickets on sale at ASO.org.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. This year's contenders for the National Book Award for Young People's Literature have been announced. And Atlanta writer Laurel Snyder is among those up for the award. Snyder's novel Orphan Island appears on what is called the long list of 10 authors who've been nominated. Other writers include Rita Williams-Garcia, Samantha Mabry, and Jason Reynolds. We spoke with Snyder earlier in the year about Orphan Island and about her approach to writing about childhood.
For me, this book began out of, in some ways, a reading of The Little Prince and then a reading of My Side of the Mountain. These two books together kind of became Orphan Island in my head as mentor texts. And I think it was important to me that this book needed to stay an allegory on some level. Even as it became a bigger, richer, more full book, I wanted it to retain that kind of allegorical quality for childhood. This book is really about Ginny leaving childhood and how hard that is. And I think there's something that we do when we write for children, where we as adults want to remember that we want to remember childhood as something sort of easier or sweeter than it was. And it was really important to me that Ginny bristle and resent and be frustrated, and especially in those moments where you're sort of becoming not a child anymore, that she'd be able to be really scared and also ready and not ready, and you know, that tension, that pulling thing that happens in you in adolescence where you're mad at everybody but you don't know why. And
you're writing for your reader, Laurel.
And I think I was saying to somebody, I think that people don't realize the biggest challenge of writing for young people is that we are writing in a language we don't really remember anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, we are not kids anymore, and we're trying to write the language of children. And we have to get our adult selves and our adult needs and our wishes for our own memories of childhood, that all has to get out of the way. So Ginny's a complicated, in some ways unlikable character. And I mean, I think she's lovable, but she's not always likable.
I was hoping you would read a passage for us, Laurel, something I especially appreciated and would love to share with listeners on page 56.
I would love to. It's funny. This is the first time I will have read this out loud to anybody. So it's exciting, but I'm afraid a little bit nervous. So this is a scene where really Ginny's just describing the island's been sort of set up almost in a sort of summer camp kind of way for the children at some way. And one of the things that's there is a cabin with a bunch of old books in it. And so she's gone to get a book from the book cabin, and she's going to read to the kids. Back at the fire circle, Ginny opened the book, cradling its worn spine in one hand as she turned the soft, crumbling pages with the other. All the kids knew to be careful with the books. They were swollen, faded, eaten by the salt air and the grit of sand, not to mention so many grubby, grabbing fingers. When a book died, there was nothing to be done about it. The kids could only bury it in the sandy earth beyond the book cabin door and try to remember the story. They marked these little graves with the biggest shells they could find. It made a funny sort of garden. Ginny wondered, whenever she walked between the carefully placed shells, what books had been there before she came to the island? What stories were planted in the ground that had died before she got there? Books she'd never know, their pictures disintegrating in the earth, their characters gone forever. It was a funny thought, strange to imagine the bright stories in the dark ground, surrounded by scuttles and bugs.
It's beautiful on different levels.
the idea of a sacred burial for books and books dying certainly attest to your love of literature, and clearly people who read this will share that. It also seems quite the metaphor for understanding death and loss, and it is called Orphan Island.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have in mind, perhaps, writing for a young reader who is afraid of losing a parent, or a reader who may have absent parents?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, I've struggled a little bit with, honestly, with even the word orphan, like with using that language. It's something that's so rooted in children's literature. It's such a trope. And I think often in children's literature, we kind of gloss over it. That sort of Harry Potter, like, lost his parents and now he's going to have a big adventure,
right?
You know?
And really happy and has magical powers.
Right. But you still get the drama of having lost. You still get the drama of having lost the parents and the search and the need and the loneliness, but it doesn't get in the way of the fun adventures and the butterbeer or whatever. And I think this was a book where it's not entirely clear. It's these children come from away and then they go back, and it's not entirely clear what their situation is. They're not entirely sure what their situation. They don't know what a parent is. And I think there was something, there's a scene in the book where she talks about not knowing, from the books in the book cabin, not knowing what's real and what's made up, that sort of unicorns and chocolate and uncles all seem like, you know, mysterious things because none of these kids have ever had any of those things. I think that I wanted to play with the idea of what children are capable of doing for themselves and taking the ways in which they can take care of themselves and grow on their own. Mm-hmm. This is not to negate the importance of loving parents, obviously, or caretakers or mentors or whatever. But I think I've written about in the past children's direct relationships with parents and losing parents in separation or in death.
Mm-hmm.
This was a book where I really, really wanted to make it all about the kids.
That was Atlanta author Laurel Snyder. Her book, Orphan Island, has been nominated for a National Book Award. In a moment on WABE, pianist Will Ransom helps us celebrate a silver anniversary.
Support for WABE comes from Atlanta History Center's Aiken Lectures, presenting Michael Twitty on Thursday, September 21st at 8 p.m. to discuss The Cooking Gene, a journey through African-American culinary history. Tickets at AtlantaHistoryCenter.com. And from the Zuckerman Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition Medium, Everyone Has a Ghost Story, What's Yours? Reception September 16th. You can learn more at zuckerman.kennesaw.edu.
This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening. You've heard the expression, where there's a will, there's a way. Music lovers in Greater Atlanta and beyond are fortunate to have a will by the last name of Ransom. 25 years ago, Will Ransom, a concert pianist and music professor at Emory University, found a way to bring chamber music to a wider part of the community now. He joins us in studio to talk about a very special occasion. Will Ransom, welcome back to City Lights.
Thanks, Lois. Always great to be here.
The Emory Chamber Music Society is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Take us back to its formation, if you will.
Well, organizations like this, once they begin, sort of often take on their own lives and start growing in ways that you didn't expect, and that's certainly what's happened here. I've loved chamber music my whole life. My sister Kate is a wonderful violinist, and from the time I was a little kid, as soon as I could reach the pedals, I was pressed into service as her accompanist, whether I wanted to be or not.
I love it, you know, imagining you like Schroeder to Kate's Lucy with a violin.
I think that's a good description of us both.
Your little toy piano.
Yeah. And I think my love of chamber music developed from there. The solo repertoire is great, and I love playing recitals, concertos as well. But there's something about making music with others and sharing that with others as well that's extra special. So I've always played a lot of chamber music, and when I got here to Atlanta, I surveyed the situation for a few years and tried to see how I could best serve the city, in a sense, in terms of music. And I certainly could have just kept practicing my solo piano and giving recitals every year. But because of my love of chamber music and what I saw as a good opening both for the city but also for Emory University, I decided to coordinate the chamber music activities that I was doing and form what was the Emory Chamber Music Society of Atlanta. It was modeled more or less after the Lincoln Center Chamber Music Society, with a core group of players who would I would choose from amongst those people, with guest artists as well, to present concerts. And in addition, and just as important, to, because we're at a university especially, have a huge educational aspect of the program as well. And that's something a lot of people know about our public concert series, but don't realize that that's only the tip of the iceberg of what we do.
For those who are not familiar with the form, what's special about chamber music?
Well, it's been described as as a group of friends who are interesting and intelligent and hopefully perhaps funny even, having a conversation through music on stage that other people can listen in on. And I love that description of it, because it's generally played in venues that are small enough where you can feel close enough to the performers to feel involved. And the performers feed off of the reaction of the audience as well, so much more so than it's even possible to do in an orchestral kind of setting.
So much of the appeal is the intimacy of the form. And I think also what you touched upon in terms of the communal aspect of it, while it may seem formal, you know, the audience is in seats, but you are sharing in this greater conversation, which is just a great way of putting it. Tell us about the gala concert this Saturday, and then we're going to listen to some music.
Great. So I wanted to celebrate, of course we'll be celebrating all season, but with a special concert that would somehow feature as much of the incredible variety of chamber music as possible, because that's another thing that makes chamber music special. It's literally an unlimited variety of instruments and combinations that you can pull together. So we're going to start with a short organ prelude with this magnificent instrument that's in Emerson Hall at Emory University. Incredible organ there with Timothy Albrecht, amazing organist. Then we'll have some antiphonal brass played from the balconies and on the stage, followed by some Lieder, some beautiful Schumann from his Dichterliebe with Bradley Howard singing. We're featuring wind chamber music with the Debussy, beautiful Debussy Rhapsody with Laura Ardan, who was a founding member of the Chamber Music Society. And the first half closes with Ravel's La Valse for two pianos with myself and Elena Cholakova, one of our brilliant faculty members at Emory.
Okay, let's listen to some examples of the music you've described. Antiphonal brass. This is brass on either side, in essence, talking to one another. This form evokes sounds of Venice and Baroque cathedrals, and we have an example in this music by Giovanni Gabrieli. Thank you. Oh, you don't have to believe in monarchy to enjoy that majestic sound, Will. How will your brass be positioned?
Well, if you know Emerson Hall, we have a balcony, and on each end of the balcony there's a little round spot. And we'll have a brass choir on each side there, and then one down on the stage as well. And if you don't know Emerson Hall, you have to come and see it, because I think it's the most beautiful venue in Atlanta.
It is gorgeous, and the acoustics are wonderful. Many associate the sound of strings first and foremost when it comes to chamber music. We have two examples, one slow and one fast in tempo. First, here is a heavenly portion of one of the greatest of all chamber works, Schubert's String Quintet in C. We're going to listen to the second movement, the slow movement. Sorry to interrupt that moment of heaven in the slow movement from Franz Schubert's String Quintet in C. But we have more music for you to listen to, highlights of this Saturday's concert by the Emory Chamber Music Society of Atlanta. If you are just joining us, this is City Lights. Our guest is pianist and Emory University professor Will Ransom. He'll tell us more about some exciting concerts this season after this break.
Support for WABE comes from Northside Drive Baptist Church, hosting speaker Dr. David Shai, educator and author specializing in intellectual and cultural history, on the pursuit of happiness, September 17th at 4 p.m., northsidedrive.org. And from Himalayan Children's Charities, empowering orphan children in Nepal to become leaders in earthquake-torn communities through education and mentorship. To help, you can visit hccnepal.org.
It's easy to look at the headlines to get a sense of the news.
Nine senators rejected that Senate version of the bill.
Venezuela was paralyzed by strikes and protests.
This missile can actually travel much farther than...
All Things Considered digs into the center of the story to help you really understand not just what's happening, but why. Stand with the facts. Listen every day. From 4 to 6:30, it's All Things Considered here on 90.1 WABE.
We're back with City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitz, is here with pianist and Emory University professor Will Ransom. He formed the Emory Chamber Music Society 25 years ago. The guest violinist for this Saturday's concert is a renowned artist with Atlanta ties that go quite far back. Will, tell us about Bill Prussell.
Bill Prussell is perhaps the most remarkable musician and certainly violinist that I know. He's been concertmaster of major orchestras. As you say, he was here in Atlanta, of course, as concertmaster, which was where I got to know him at first, and is now concertmaster of the Cleveland Orchestra, perhaps one of the greatest orchestras in the world. In between, he was first violin with the Cleveland String Quartet, and he plays recitals, he plays concertos. He knows the entire repertoire, not just in one field. And I don't know anybody else that I can say that about. And he knows it backwards and forwards. And of course, just the way he plays makes all of that just almost secondary. So I'm thrilled that he could come back to Atlanta and be part of this celebration. And he's going to be leading the string groups on the second half. And what I've done to show the great variety of string works is to put together sort of a whole piece of four movements, four of my favorite movements from four different composers, a Beethoven string quartet, last movement, and then that gorgeous Schubert. You should come to the concert just to hear that movement of the Schubert two cello quintet, the scherzo from Tchaikovsky's A Serenade of Florence, and ending with the brilliant last movement of Mendelssohn's Octet.
And we have a recording of Bill Prussell with his wife, Gwen Starker, and a group of friends from the ASO playing that final movement from Mendelssohn's Octet for strings. Let's hear it. Okay, do you hear, "And he shall reign forever and ever" in that?
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm so glad. I feel so validated that you hear that too. We were listening to a moment from Mendelssohn's Octet for Strings, that from the finale, and part of the program to be performed on a free concert this Saturday in Emory University's Schwartz Center for the Performing Arts. We're going to take a short break, and Will Ransom will tell us more about the upcoming season here on WABE.
Support for WABE comes from Capital One. You can open a Capital One savings account and discover more about Capital One savings online at CapitalOne.com/ReimagineAtlanta. Capital One, welcome to banking reimagined. And from Comcast Business. Comcast is committed to providing dependable internet service for businesses who depend on it. Comcast Business, internet, voice, and TV, built for business.
We're back with City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes here with pianist and Emory University professor Will Ransom. He formed the Emory Chamber Music Society 25 years ago and will be celebrating throughout this season. Will, one of the things you have achieved that's been so impressive is not only offering chamber music to a wider audience, but a more inclusive audience. And we hear so much concern about attracting younger people, children, to classical music. How do you address that?
Well, we're lucky to be based at a university, which gives us a big foot up, so to speak, on educational aspects and working with people of all ages and diversity as well. And in terms of specifically young audiences and children in particular, we do have a family series which invites kids in to hear programs that are designed specifically for young audiences in mind, but actually work for audiences of all ages. I personally hate programs that sort of dumb down the music to try and make it so-called accessible to children. I don't think you have to do that. I think if you present the greatest possible music in the right way, with the right players and the right introductions, that kids will just eat it up. And we found that to be the case. And our family series at Emory is at the Carlos Museum Sundays at 4 p.m. and have a whole variety of different concerts, and they're packed, and the kids sit on the floor right at our feet. There are so many of them. and to watch their faces glow with joy and see them dancing around to the music and moving, there's really nothing more fulfilling than that.
It is fantastic. And these concerts are free. And Will, not only is this stellar lineup you have on Saturday free, but I believe this season is free. Is that correct? How did you pull that off?
Well, the generosity of so many people has been really quite overwhelming over these 25 years. And what I started about 6 or 7 years ago, when we were starting a major fund drive, we had received $1 million matching challenge grant from the Katz Foundation to permanently endow a string quartet in residence program at Emory. And in doing that, I decided, rather than charge for tickets, to make the concerts free and open to the public and ask for donations there. And I thought that perhaps especially because of the matching challenge, that would attract more people. And the response was unbelievable. Our halls just started filling up, and we started receiving more in donations than we were in ticket prices. So it suddenly something clicked, and I realized, maybe this is the key. And I've been able to continue that, again, because of the generosity of so many who have given enough funds to underwrite and to permanently endow what we do.
So people who may not otherwise be able to afford a concert ticket are able to hear, you know, world-renowned musicians and, you know, the finest in chamber music, the finest this city and this community has to offer.
Yes, thanks. And what I also think is a really important part of the success of what we do is that I like to have fun at concerts as well. And so on this program on Saturday night, which, as you say, is free, open to the public, no tickets, no reservations needed. We'll also have cake at intermission. And if you make even a small donation, you will have a chance to win one of $200 Visa gift cards as well.
leave it to you. I said, where there's a will, there's a whole lot of wonderful concert and fun experience at the Schwartz Center. Okay, we're going to conclude with some music. You will perform at Saturday night's gala, Will, in its orchestral form. La Valse by Maurice Ravel is dazzling. Mm-hmm. In the two-piano version, which you'll play with your Emory colleague, the wonderful pianist Elena Cholokova, it is a knuckle-buster.
It is.
Fiercely difficult and fabulous to listen to. Here is some of La Valse in the two piano version by Ravel. A French tribute to old Vienna, La Valse by Maurice Ravel, one of several works celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Emory Chamber Music Society. They'll perform a gala concert this Saturday at Emory Schwartz Center. Admission is free. That's Saturday, September 16th at 8 p.m. Pianist Will Ransom is founder and artistic director. Will, congratulations on your silver anniversary of the Chamber Music Society. You bring sterling qualities to music and our community.
Thank you, Lois. Here's to the next 25 years.
Ah, yes. And happy birthday, Dr. Ransom.
Great way to celebrate.
You've been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. You can catch an encore broadcast of our show this evening at 8. Tomorrow morning at 11. Words are everywhere. Designer and podcaster Debbie Millman will join us to talk about the ways that typography has worked its way into every aspect of our existence. City Lights is a production of WABE at Public Broadcasting Atlanta. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Mike Johns, and Gabby Watts. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. And our MVP of radio is Christine Dempsey. I'm Lois Reitzes. I would love it if you'd follow me on Twitter, at Lois Reitzes. That's LOISREITZES. You can follow our station at WABE News. That's all for today's edition of City Lights. Here and Now comes your way next, followed by A Closer Look with Rose Scott. Thanks for joining us and for listening to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.